Hey, you're tuned in to the Verve Podcast, live from the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks for listening, and viva la Verve! Hey, so, everybody have a good holiday? Good? Yeah, I'm curious, so, how many of you guys already have your Christmas tree up? Yeah, that's a good number, that's right. You know, my house, and this, of course, is completely initiated by my wife and my daughter, it's a must that right after Thanksgiving, preferably for them the day after, but that weekend, the Christmas tree must go up. And so the last couple days, we've spent decorating, trimming the tree, baking sugar cookies, listening to Christmas carols, that sort of thing, and having a blast doing it. But I have to tell you, I honestly cannot go through that experience without thinking back to a time when I was just a little boy or a young boy. And with my own family, my parents and my sister, and a tree trimming time that we had ourselves. In fact, I was about 11 or 12 years old. I was just getting to that point where I was a little bit full of myself, getting a little bit full of moxie, maybe a smart aleck, you might say. And there was already tension between me and my father, but I was really exploring that tension and seeing how far I could actually push it. And so I remember this one year, we were going to pick out our Christmas tree, and back in the East Coast where I grew up, they would have these places called Christmas tree farms, where they would just have rows and rows of Christmas trees, pine trees, pine tree after pine tree, and there would be like blue spruce pine, and then there would be like, you know, I don't really know any other types of pine, but long needles, short needle, cones, no cones, you know, whatever you wanted. So there was all these trees, and the object was you could go out and you could pick out whatever tree you wanted, cut it down, take it home, that's your tree. And so we would go, and I remember my mom, my dad, my sister, me, we're all walking through, and my mom spots a tree, and she's like, that's the tree. There it is, it's beautiful, because that's how my mom talked. And so she saw this beautiful tree, a very full tree, which is very rare for a live tree. No, none of those like, hey, you got to stick that part in the corner. It was a beautiful tree. And so my dad immediately goes in inspection mode. Let me see. And so I say to my dad, I asked my dad the question that I would invariably ask during the stage. I said, hey, Dad, you think this year I could cut it down? And he would say something like this. Oh, you know you're not good at that stuff, boy. You better leave it to me. You know, like that. Because he was always telling me what I wasn't very good at, right? You know, and for me, unfortunately, pretty much I wasn't good at anything that he was good at. And he was never telling me what else I might be good at. It was just always like, oh, you know you can't handle that. So he get, you know, my mom picked up the tree, he get in his inspection mode, and he sounded like this. You know, like, because that's how it sounded to me. And he was getting down to check out where he was going to start cutting the trunk. And so I start looking at the tree for myself, and I'm looking through the branches, and I'm like, oh, hold on, hold up, wait. This is not good. The trunk is crooked. I mean, it's good for about halfway up, and then all of a sudden the trunk just grows crooked. And it was. I don't know if somebody had trimmed the branches shorter on one side and left them long on the other and make it full, but sure enough, about midway up, the trunk went from straight to crooked. And I said, isn't that going to cause a problem? Maybe it might fall over. And my dad gets up and says, well, hey, how long you been doing this, boy? I don't know, not very long. I said, how long I've been doing it, you know? Longer than me, you know? Well, why don't you leave it to me then? You know, that kind of thing. And so I was like, all right, whatever. So he starts cutting the tree down. Timber falls over. Bam. We throw it up on top of the hood of the car, on top of the car, rope it down, head home. Everyone's excited for the tree trimming. We're ready to go. Get out the stand, get the tree in the stand, start getting it all set up. And you know what happened? That thing started to tip over. And I'm all, I guess I'm not too good at the zzz, zzz, but I'm pretty good at the, that might fall over stuff, right? You know, my dad's like, it'll make it work. And so he's turning the pegs. I mean, he's turning those pegs. Those pegs are like 2 inches deep into the trunk at the base. And he goes out of the garage. He starts cutting a piece of wood. He gets a piece of wood. He wedges it down in the stand. He is determined that he is going to make this tree stand up. He will not be wrong about this. So he gets the tree to stand. We get some lights up on it. We get the ornaments put on it. Everybody's happy. Oh, it's a beautiful tree. Mom's happy. It's all great. And he's like, all right, good night. So we all go to bed, and then in the middle of the night, how do you say, arose such a clatter? Because you know what happened, and suddenly, crash, boom, bang, psh, glass break and everything. My sister and I come running out of our bedrooms. We're like, what was that? Oh, my gosh, burglar, thief, whatever. My parents come around, they're all bleary-eyed. Oh, they turn on the lights, and sure enough, the Christmas tree is laying on its side, falling over. And my mom is just all upset. She's picking up ornaments and what's left of ornaments, saying, this is a family ball. Oh, you ruined it, Mom. You should have listened to him. And he's all, and he stood there, and this is what he said. I can't believe that thing fell over. And I said, I can. Nobody else is in disbelief. You know, it's like, of course it fell over. So my dad, listen, get this. He's so determined. He's a very determined guy. So he has me help him in the middle of the night, pick the tree up, set it back up right. He goes, gets rope, kid you not, ties rope to the trunk, two ropes, sends them out, and then stakes them into the windowsill so that the tree is stood up. So for the remainder of the holiday season, we had a rope stake tree to the windowsill, and people would come over and be like, hey, what's with the ropes, Bob? And he'd be like, well, it gave me a little trouble. And I'd be like, idiots. You know, it was like that kind of Christmas. And those kind of experiences happened a lot when I was young, and I had some takeaways from those types of things. I mean, here's a few. Number one, I was kind of the oddball in my family. Like, whatever it was that my parents were good at, I just wasn't good at those things. And I was constantly, like I told you, being told, oh, you're not good at that. You're not good at that. And it felt like there was this great divide and this great tension, but no one was telling me what I was good at. And I always felt like the oddball. My parents were both the type of people that they just sort of believed that work was a curse, that your life's work was just this curse that you had to endure, and you just had to go and slave away at it. No one loves it. No one likes it. But you work hard so that you can come home and then do the things you love to do, and this was their mentality. And I just wasn't wired that way. And so I thought, I was insatiably curious, and so I'd ask questions all the time. I'd be like, why? Why do people do that? I'm sure maybe there's a good reason. I mean, it's been done that way for a long time, but maybe we can think of a better reason why. And my parents were always like, no, you ask too many questions. Your curiosity is going to get you in trouble. And you know what? They were right. In a lot of ways, my curiosity got me in a lot of trouble. But I just couldn't accept those things, and we were just different. And I was the oddball. I was the odd man out in my family, and so it always felt like this great tension. And so the second takeaway I took from experiences like that when I was a child were that stubbornness. My dad was very stubborn, and stubbornness very rarely led to the result that he actually wanted. No one was wishing for a roped, held-up tree that Christmas. You know, it was like, if we could just have ropes holding our tree up. You know, no one was. But the stubbornness seldom led to the result he wanted. And the third takeaway I took away from experiences like that was that pride very rarely helps you. Pride, in fact, will keep you from listening to the voice of reason. And you might be thinking at this point, well, yeah, sure, because your daddy was so proud he wouldn't listen to the voice of reason of his 12-year-old son. But no, I'm talking about me. Because what would happen as a result of some of those experiences, I became this incredibly proud person. I developed quite an ego. In fact, I would go on this journey where if somebody told me that I was wrong or somebody told me I wasn't good at something, my goal in life became to prove them wrong, to show them, no, I can do the thing that you say I can't do. I'm so tired of being told I can't do it that I will show you. In fact, I will do it so well, I will do it better than you. I'll prove to you that you're wrong about me, that you can't just put me in that kind of thing. So if you say I'm not good at it, I'll prove that I am good at it. And this became my mission in life, and it was all centered around this pride that I had. And here's the problem, though. My dad was right about a lot of stuff. He was right. I wasn't good at a lot of those things. And so I spent a great deal of my life trying to prove people wrong about me, trying to do things, and every time I would put a lot of effort and a lot of labor, spend hours working on something, and then somebody would invariably come along and just do it better than me. Like as if it was as easy as breathing for them. They just come and go, oh, it's like this and this, and I'd be like, what? What? I've spent so much time on that. I took wood shop thinking it would be an easy A. It was a hard D. I just wasn't good at some of those things. And so it was a very difficult journey for me, and it took me years to realize some things. And in fact, if I can be honest, a lot of this stuff didn't get remedied for me until I became a follower of Jesus. When I was 27 years old, I became connected to our Creator through Jesus, and it started to open my eyes to things that I'd never realized before. And I stopped listening to the voices of the past, and I started listening to a new voice. And this voice was powerful and amazing, and it really changed me. And I remember one of the scripture passages that I came across. I started reading the Bible, the scriptures, and I remember this one passage I came across, and it just blew me away. And so I'm going to read it to you. It's not going to come up on the screen, but I am going to read it. It's in the book of Psalms. And so I should tell you that the Psalms are like a collection of writings in the Bible. They're often poems, some of them just straight rants. It's like, God, why? So I could really relate to it. Some of them are songs that are just sung to God, and someone who's into music, I really like that. And so these psalmists would write these words, and they were called psalms. And so I'm going to read Psalm 139, pick up in verse 13. I'm just going to, again, not on the screen, so just listen. Psalm 139, the psalmist says this. I write the psalms that make the whole world sing. No? Seriously? No love for Manilow? No Barry Manilow in Vegas? You know he prefer... Never mind. All right, so, it's a tough crowd. Go, Rob. Keep moving. Army of one. Go. All right. So, Psalm 139, starting verse 13. Check this out. Listen. For you, God. These are written to God. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. The word fearfully there literally means like with great reverence and respect. That God made you and made me with great respect, with great care. It was no accident, it was no coincidence. He actually put thought into it. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. I have to tell you, that blew me away. It blew me away. And it changed me. And suddenly I had this shift of thought where I started to realize, man, there has to be something in me that's good. There must be some strength. I'm not good at the things that my parents were good at, and I'm not good at the things that other people are good at, but there has to be something in here that's valuable and good. If that's true, there has to be something in me that is productive and right and could produce something in these days that I've been given that could be beautiful. And it changed the way I thought. And what happened for me was this change of thought occurred where I stopped spending so much energy trying to prove everybody wrong about me, and I started trying to prove that right. You see the difference? I stopped trying to say, oh, you're wrong about me, I'll prove you wrong. And I started saying, if that's, I'm gonna prove that right. There's something in me that's good. And so it took me years to figure it out, well into my adult life. In fact, the way I would treat employers were greatly affected by some of those experiences from my past. The way I would interact with employees and employers at jobs were affected by those things, trying to prove them wrong about me. And suddenly I just released that, and I started to say, I'm going to prove this right. But it took me years to figure this one thing out, that if I could figure out what my strengths were, what my God-given strengths were, and if I could exploit those strengths, they would be far more valuable to any organization that I chose to align myself with, to my family, to my friends, than any single one of my marginally improved weaknesses could ever be. I'll say it again. If I could exploit my God-given strengths, it would become far more valuable to any organization I chose to align myself with, to my family, to my friends, to everyone I interacted with on this earth, than any single marginally improved weakness could ever be. Now, don't hear me wrong. We could all be better organizers, better time managers, better listeners. But there are some things that we just can't do because we're not wired for that. I mean, we grow up in America where we're taught, and it's a beautiful idea, that you can do whatever you want. You set your sights on it, you can do it. But you know it's not true, right? I mean, you do know. I mean, I grew up wanting to play in the NBA. I have a few barriers to being able to play in the National Basketball Association. Number one, I'm not incredibly tall. I'm not very fast. I don't dribble basketball very well. And I am really, really white. And so it never was going to pan out for me. You know, it just wasn't for me. Didn't mean I didn't want, I mean, I loved it, but you just can't do it. And so I want to talk to you about a story in the Bible today. It's in the Old Testament. It's in the older section of the Scriptures about a guy that I'm sure you've all heard of, regardless of your spiritual experience or whatever affiliation you might or might have had with what you consider to be religion. And it's about a guy named Moses. I'm sure you've heard him. At the very least, you've heard somebody say, "Holy Moses!" That's him. That's the guy we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about Holy Moses. And so before we really get into the story, I feel like I should give you some background information. Moses was a guy. He was a Hebrew. And the Hebrews were God's chosen people. And in a bizarre set of circumstances, Moses got to grow up in the house of the Pharaoh. Now, the Pharaoh was the king of Egypt. He was the most powerful man in the world. And Egypt enslaved the Hebrew nation. So the Hebrew nation were slaves to Egypt. But in a bizarre set of circumstances, Moses, a Hebrew, gets to grow up in the house of Pharaoh, gets to get an education, gets all these benefits. And then in another set of bizarre circumstances, he sort of becomes an exile. He gets forced out, and he has to flee to the desert. He takes a wife and has kids. And he's out in the desert, and at some point, God comes to Moses and says, "I want you to go back to Egypt. I want you to stand in front of Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world, and I want you to say, 'Let my people go.' I've heard the cries of my people, and I want you to say, 'Let my people go.'" And Moses says, "Mm-mm. you got the wrong guy for the job. And Moses, and God says, I got the right guy. Moses says, I'm not the right guy. And he starts, I mean, my brother. And God says, who made you? Who made you? I made you. Fearfully and wonderfully. And I don't make mistakes. And I want you to go back to Egypt, and I want you to tell the Pharaoh, let my people go. And so Moses goes before the Pharaoh, and he says, let my people go. And the Pharaoh says, no. And he says, let my people go. And the Pharaoh says, no. And he says, let my people go. And the Pharaoh says, no. And it goes on and on. And so God says, I'm going to send plagues. And so plagues befall Egypt, and there's gnats and frogs and blood and riverways and all this incredible stuff that's normally reserved for sci-fi movies, but it's real, and it's happening. And suddenly the Pharaoh relents, and he says, fine, take the people, go, just get them out of here. So Moses takes the entire Hebrew nation and flees and leaves Egypt. The Pharaoh has a change of heart and says, I go after them, and sends an army after them. And then in this incredible scene at the Red Sea, the Hebrew nation gets away, and the plot of the Pharaoh is foiled as the army is just lost in the Red Sea, and it's an amazing experience. Moses finds himself out in the desert now with the entire Hebrew nation. Now, scholars and historians and architects and stuff, they disagree on the amount of people it was, but in the high end, they would think it was somewhere around 3 million people. And on the low end, it was probably at least 1 million people. So for our purposes tonight, we'll say 2 million, which, interestingly enough, is the population of our city, about 2 million here in the middle of the desert. So imagine the scene. Moses is got this population the size of this city out in the middle of the desert, no government, no infrastructure, no systems. Some of you might think, well, that's kind of how we are, right? I don't know. I'm not judging. Anyway, so Moses has all these people out in the middle of the desert. There's no systems. There's no structure. There's nothing. And they're kind of like, well, what are we supposed to do now? I mean, we're used to somebody telling us when to eat. We're used to somebody telling us when to do what, and we don't really know what to do. It's all we've ever known is slavery. They've been enslaved for 400 years. And so Moses is about to get a visitor. And the visitor is his father-in-law. His father-in-law is bringing his wife and children to him from the desert because he had to leave them behind when he went back to Egypt to free the Hebrew people. And his father-in-law is coming into town. And he's got a visitor. And so that's where we pick up the story in Exodus chapter 18. If you have a Bible, we'd love for you to turn there. If you don't, it's okay. It's going to be on the screen. And if you don't have a Bible, we give them away for free at the Welcome Center and Hub table out there in the middle of the room. Just go grab one. So here we pick it up. It's going to come up behind me. Exodus 18 says this. So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him, just like you and I do, right? That's what we do, right? In fact, I just saw my father-in-law this week. You know what? Actually, I was actually going to do this. I was actually going to bow down and kiss him and have Logan film it for you guys when I went to see him and then show it on the screen. I thought it would be funny, but I chickened out. I did. Yeah, because I just can't kiss that man. So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down and kissed him. They greeted each other and then went into the tent. And then what happens is, you know, his father-in-law named Jethro, I kid you not, Jethro, says, tell me everything. How did this happen? How did you get out of here? And so Moses starts telling him, oh, it's incredible. I mean, I went before the Pharaoh and I was like, and I was all, let my people go. And he was all, no, and I was all, and he was all. And, you know, and then all these plagues and gnats and frogs and blood and rivers, it was incredible. And they said, go. And then they came after us. And then the Red Sea and the whole thing, it was bizarre. And Jethro said, oh, it's just amazing. Oh, my gosh. God has rescued you. And so it's this amazing scene. And somehow in the course of that conversation, it's decided that Jethro will come to work with Moses the next day. So I guess it's like the first ever bring your father-in-law to work day. I don't know. But the next day, Moses goes to do his thing. He's trying to set up some structure here for the people. And Jethro, his father-in-law, comes along to take witness of it. And then we pick it up in verse 13. It says, the next day Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening. When his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, what is this you are doing for the people? I still think that's worded funny. No one thinks so but me, but I do. Why do you alone sit as judge while all these people stand around you from morning till evening? And Moses answered him, because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it is brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and laws. Moses' father-in-law replied, what you are doing is not good. Notice, he did not say, you are not doing a good job. He said, what you are doing is not good. The inference here, of course, would be, it doesn't matter how good a job you do, the thing you're doing is not good. Doesn't matter how good a job you do. This had to really just stop Moses for a second. I have to think that this had to be a jolt for Moses. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I don't think so. Because I have to think there was a part of Moses that was kind of hoping that his father-in-law would be out there, and he'd be like, look how important I am. The entire nation lines up to come and see me, and I decide between their disputes. So this has got to be a wild scene. It's got to be like, all right, hey, I said, yeah, my chicken, they took my chicken. They can't take my chicken. And Moses was like, yeah, you're right. You know, you can't take his chicken. I mean, God wouldn't want you to take his chicken. Oh, we can't take a chicken? No, you can't take a chicken. Oh, I didn't know you couldn't take a chicken. And it had to be like stuff like that. And then somebody else coming up, oh, my tent collapsed in the middle of the night, man. The pegs were all pulled up. It was his teenagers. It wasn't my teenagers. You know, what, the Lowenstein boys? Seriously? No way. That's funny, by the way. They were Jews, guys. Seriously. So anyway, So Moses is handling these type of disputes, and I'm sure he's thinking that Jethro is going to be like, oh my gosh, my daughter hit the mother load. He is so important. They just line up just to get his opinion about matters like this. This is huge. He had to be thinking, he's going to love it. That's not what happens. Jethro says, what you're doing is not good. It's simply not good. It's not a good thing for you. You are going to wear yourself out. You are going to wear these people out. This is all wrong. And he goes on to explain this. We'll pick it back up in verse 18. Coming up behind me. He'll say this. You and these people who have come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen now to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you, which, by the way, rings a little bit of the, have you ever heard anybody in the South who says, like, oh, bless your heart, which really means, you poor son of a, you have nothing going on. So I don't know. This is like, may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them the decrees and laws and show them the way to live and the duties they are to perform. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter because they will share it with you. If you do this and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied. Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. This is incredible. I mean, you see, I think what Jethro is hitting at here is like, he's saying, if you do these things, you'll be able to handle the strain. And then everyone will be satisfied. And in other words, like, and I think this is a misconception in our lives. We think when we get stressed, when we're at the workplace and we get stressed, I think a lot of us tend to think that it has to do with the amount of work we're doing. Like, we always say things like, I've got so much to do, I've got to do this, and I got to do that, and I got this to do and that to do. But the truth is, stress is very rarely related to the amount of stuff we have to do. It's normally related to what we do. And you probably know this to be true in your life, because you know there's probably some things in your sweet spot that if you did those things, you could do them all day long. In fact, those things are so sweet for you that when you're doing them, you have to remind yourself to pull away and say, you know what, I do have other responsibilities. I probably should take care of some of these other matters. I can only imagine Moses' pushback to this. I can only imagine that Moses would say something like, wait a minute, I don't have time. But you want me to set up all this infrastructure and stuff? I don't have time. Who's got time for that? I'm busy. Morning till evening, people are lining up. I don't have time for that. It's just easier if I did it myself. That's never been said, right? No. But see, what Moses has done here is he's made a classic leadership blunder. In fact, he's made a classic work blunder. We've probably all done it. What he's done is Moses has accepted a task or a role that is actually distracting him from doing the thing that he was made to do. He's taken a role that is keeping him from his primary responsibility, from actually flourishing within his God-given strength. He's taken a task and a role that distracts him from who he really is. This is a classic blunder. If you lead people at your work, if you're in management of any kind, or if you run any employees, I'm sure you've made the same mistake. There's probably some task that you've been assigned or you've agreed to that actually keeps you from doing your primary responsibility and doing the thing that you really love to do. Or maybe you work for someone like that. I mean, we've all had that where it's like, man, if our boss would just do this and let me do the thing I'm good at, man. Because most of us, I've met a few employees in my day, and most people actually think they can do parts of their job better than their boss. You know, like again, never happens, right? But Moses made this classic mistake. And so what Jethro was saying is like, look, you are unique. You've been uniquely positioned, Moses. You can actually be God's representative to the entire nation. How many people can do that? How many people have the unique qualifications you have? How many people have it built in them? How many people are wired in such a way that they could go stand in front of the most powerful man in the world and say, let my people go? Why would God choose you? You could stand in front of God on behalf of the entire nation. The others cannot. Do the thing you were made to do. Then find other capable men. In other words, there are other gifted people here. Let them use their gifts. And let them rise up and do the things that they were meant to do. And then you will all be satisfied. Find out where their gifts are. Empower them. Put them in positions. Now, here's the thing that just blows my mind about the passage, if I can be honest. It says this. Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything that he said. Like, this is actually unbelievable to me. I mean, really. Because to me, it just seems like Moses could have really pushed hard on Jethro. I'm pretty sure that Moses could have probably kind of taken this position. He could have been like my dad, maybe, and been like so stubborn and be like, mm-mm, I got it. You know, nobody's going to tell me. I've got this. He could have been prideful like me. He could have been like, no, if you say I'm wrong about something, I will prove to you that you're wrong about me. But he doesn't. Moses, a highly capable individual, obviously, is teachable and coachable. And he takes some advice from a very unlikely source. Because I don't know if you know this, but Jethro is actually a shepherd. Mm-hmm. He's probably got a little operation going with maybe 3 or 4 of his sons. That's his job qualifications. And suddenly he's acting as consultant to Moses, who's the leader of a nation. I can only imagine it would have been easy for Moses to say, yeah, you know what, thanks, seriously, Jethro. I got this. You know, I don't know if you know this, Jethro, but I'm sort of a big deal. People know me. My tent smells of rich mahogany, and I have many leather-bound books. I don't know. But I'm sure he could have said, Jethro, seriously, what do you got going on there? You a shepherd? Oh, that's great. What do you got going on? A little operation with your boys? A little 3-4 boys? Yeah, Anita, bravo. Yeah, you know. Yeah, you know, I'm a deliverer. God says, bring my people. I deliver the goods. I mean, I'm an emancipator. I'm a freedom fighter. What are you going to tell me? How to run this nation? I mean, seriously, Jethro? I mean, people aren't going to say, holy Jethro. No, they say, holy Moses. Because I'm Moses. I can only imagine what he could have said. And yet he didn't. He actually listened and did everything that he said. He was coachable. From the most unlikely source. It's like God sent the most unlikely individual to say, hey, look, remember who you are. Remember who you were made to be and go do that. Do what only you can do and let other people do what they were made to do and everyone will be satisfied. It's just an amazing, amazing idea. And I wonder if the same might not be true for you tonight. Could it be? And I'm sure for some of you, honestly, some of you are probably still like, I can't even believe I'm sitting in a church. Like, I'm even listening. And I'm sure there's some pushback. I'm sure you might be even thinking, I really appreciate the series. Guys, seriously, I appreciate what Vince has been saying. I appreciate, Rob, what you're saying. But seriously, what do you know about what goes on at work, in my workplace? I mean, you really don't know. I'm sure you can push back. But could it be that God has given you this unlikely source, people who might pour into you and say, you know what? We have a thing or two to say because we are connected to our Creator in Christ. Could it be that that the church could be the most informative group on this issue. And I don't mean like the church in the religious sense, maybe like the religious institutional sense. I mean, could it be that if you were with a group of Jesus followers, people who are following Jesus, passionately connected to their Creator in Christ, could it be that maybe they could help you figure out maybe how you are uniquely wired and maybe some of the things that really make you tick, and they could help you on this journey to unleashing this potential that you have to bring about an incredible life work? I'm not sure how you feel about that, but I know it's true. In fact, I'll tell you a couple stories. We have this class. We have this structure here called Verve University where we have these core classes that we make available for the people. And one of them is called Verb. And Verb is all about this sort of action orientation. It's all about, like, what do I do with my life? And we teach three core things in Verb. We talk a lot about character, about having people of good character, godly character. We talk a great deal about self-awareness. Who am I? How am I wired? How was I made to live? And then proactivity. What do we do? What was our life meant to produce? And so back in the summer, we had about 22 or 23 people, I can't remember, attend Verb, and it was a great class. And I'd like to share a couple stories that came out of that. One is the story of a girl named Amanda. The young lady here, Amanda, and she's a paralegal at a law firm. And I hope I tell this right, but here's Amanda's circumstance. She's at work, and there's a promotion that becomes available at her work, and she decides to go for it. She applies for it. But in order to get it, she has to sit in front of a lawyer and be interviewed, and the lawyer that she has to sit in front of is sort of the firm's tough lawyer, the hard lawyer, you know what I'm saying? So she has to sit down, and no one likes this part of the process anyway. And then the lawyer asks her the dreaded question that we all hate in the interview process, which is this: so what are your strengths? Because we never know how to really answer that without coming across arrogant, but we know we don't want to talk down about ourselves, and there's always that tension. But Amanda, with great confidence, just kind of sat and said, actually, I do know my strengths. I have five key strengths as I understand them, and here's what they are, and here's how they all work together. Here's how they play out in my life. I can give you examples, and here's probably maybe how you've seen them at play in the office. Lawyer said, I've never heard anybody articulate their strengths so well. Amanda got the promotion. Incredible. There's another young lady here named Mia. Mia came through the Verb class, and Mia is a regional manager for a very popular clothing line and clothing store. And so she oversees many stores and their management and then employees in those stores. And so Mia began to identify some things in herself, and she was figuring out, like, how I'm wired and how I'm made. And then as a result of that, she was realizing that other people aren't wired the same way that she is, and she was trying to figure out, I think I have employees who are like this, and maybe I need to handle them differently, and it was great. And so she began to apply these things at her workplace, and employees started to come to her and say, Mia, what happened? Because you're different now, and no offense, but it's better. And, what happened? And she said, oh, well, they taught this class at my church, and it was all about how to figure out how you're wired and how, you know. And they were like, what? They taught you this at church? Yeah. And there was another guy named Chris, and he came to me and he said, I wish that someone would come to my workplace and teach this stuff, because I can't tell you how much friction there is over people doing the wrong thing and doing what other people should be doing. If they could just figure out what they should be doing and have other people do what they should be doing, it would all go so much smoother and everybody would just be happier. Could it be that God, you have a God that created you, and he knows best how he wired you, and he didn't make a mistake when he created you, and he put strengths in you, and if you could identify them, your life work could be amazing. Could it be? I would say yes. So the band's going to be coming back up, and we're going to start winding it down. We're going to do some songs together, and then we're going to have a time of reflection. And some things I just want you to think about. Or what if you have a God that created you, and he did not make a mistake. And he put strengths in you. Would you be willing to investigate those strengths? We're going to be offering Verb again at the turn of the new year. Would you be willing to investigate those strengths? Would you be willing to unleash some of those strengths? Would you be willing to exploit some of those strengths and become far more valuable to your organization that you're aligned with, to your family, to your friends, to this church, to this community, to this city? Would you be willing? And I want you to hear this right. This story, the story with Moses, I mean, maybe as a subplot, it's about being a better delegator, but don't miss it. It's not just be a better delegator. It's do what only you can do. Do what you are made to do. Because when you do, you will experience a joy that you've never experienced through work. I kid you not. You will experience joy. And when you start to experience the joy, you know what that is? That's the joy of God. That's the joy of your Creator, whether you're a believer or not. When you get in tune with how your Creator made you, it's incredible. So I'm going to pray some songs, reflections. Just mull that over for a while. And God, thanks for tonight, for the chance that we have to be together. God, I thank you so much that you made us with great respect and thoughtfulness. That this is not an accident. That our lives are no coincidence, God. That we have purpose. We have things that we were made to produce in this life. And I pray for each person that's within earshot of my voice right now, that they would really begin to take this in and say, I have a responsibility to figure these things out. I've been listening to the wrong voices. I've let experiences of my past affect who I am, and I'm not listening to the right voice, the voice of my Creator. God, I thank you for giving us Jesus, who made all this possible. And I pray in his name. Amen.